This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. North Carolina has its share of great science fiction and fantasy writers. One of them is David Drake, well-respected in the world of military sci-fi, but he is not locked into a narrow genre. His latest book, Monsters of the Earth, is the third in a fantasy series set in a world that looks suspiciously like ancient Rome. David Drake is going to be at the Barnes & Noble in Cary tonight for the book launch, and he joins us now to talk more about Monsters of the Earth. Welcome, David Drake.
Hi, Frank. I'm terrified.
This is the monster you have to face.
Hey, the public. In my perfect world, I'm sitting in the middle of my 23 acres with my word processor and my dog at my feet. This is not that place.
Yeah, but you know, as an author and as a Latin scholar, they are the sine qua non of your profession.
Unfortunately, that is absolutely correct, and I get rained on sometimes also.
Tell us about this third book in the series, the Element series, a series but not necessarily a serial. We don't have to know 1, 2 to know 3.
No, actually, that's an important thing about it. I started out writing short stories for science fiction magazines back in the 60s. And I'm old. And you could not assume that somebody who picked up the July issue of Galaxy would have read the November issue of the previous year. And every story, whether or not it was in series, had to be self-standing. And I've been writing novels now since 1979, and I do it the same way.
You figured out how to do it. Well, give us the background then on this particular book, Monsters of the Earth.
I have four viewpoint characters. They are people of their own time, which, as you say, is a lot like Rome in 30 AD. But let me emphasize that I am writing fantasy novels. I'm not writing historicals with a fantasy element, and I deliberately don't call the place Rome. I call it Carsey, which is not Rome. Really, in Rome, we are absolutely certain that demons did not rise up in the middle of the Capitolium and devour the whole temple. We're really
pretty sure that didn't happen.
Yes,
they tried.
They might have. They might have. But
it wasn't recorded. See,
it didn't make the historical record.
But here's an interesting thing. Okay, so obviously there are differences. You're writing fantasy, but you said something like Rome around 30 AD. So you really have a picture of a place and a time.
Oh, hell
somehow.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's how I work. I mean, that's how I'm comfortable. I need to have the underpinnings down. And I read Latin for fun. I translate Latin on my website for fun. I mean, you know, there's no money in
this.
There's
really something wrong with you, David. But tell me about that. Tell me about
there is.
tell me about your love of Latin now, because I endured 3 years of that, and I kind of did like it, but it was hard, and I don't enjoy it. What drew you to Latin?
Well, it's funny. I had 2 years of Latin in high school, and I didn't like it any better than you did.
Okay.
Reasonably good at it. I went off to college and the University of Iowa. It was the student body was half the size of the city I'd come from. Everything was completely new, foreign. There was no security in my world anymore. And I had started taking German because this was going to be a useful language, and I was going to be a patent lawyer specializing in chemistry. Okay, I had it all planned out. Jeepers. I was 18.
Yeah.
I didn't know, but I knew what I was going to do. And I was going to pieces, and I realized that I could not bring back the security of high school in any significant fashion. Look, I don't mean I had a good time in high school. I just meant it was secure. I knew my place.
Right.
And the one thing I could do was go back to Latin. And so at least I would have the foreign language I was taking would be the same. And I really got into it. And at the end of my undergraduate career, I was a history major, as it turned out. But at the end of my career, I had 30-odd semester hours of Latin, and I said to my advisor, well, could I have a double major? And he said, yeah, why not? So I am a history and Latin major, and I went to Duke Law School. While I was in the law school, I was taking auditing courses in the Latin department.
And you're still interested and still active? And the poet Virgil plays a part in,
oh,
in
yes.
the latest book.
Yes.
Who to me is a Homer knockoff. I'm sorry. I mean, I'm sorry to be so harsh, but after all, is no Iliad.
You are absolutely correct. Or to be more accurate, it's both. Because the first half is the Iliad, and the second half is the Odyssey. I mean, vice versa.
Mm-hmm,
but,
sure.
You know, he really does knock off. But Homer was an artist, and Virgil is a craftsman. And God may make artists. He certainly didn't make me one, but he did allow me to become a craftsman. Craft is something you learn.
So what part does he play in your book?
there is a medieval myth, and it is a myth, probably came out of Naples, that Virgil was a great magician, Virgil Magus, Virgil the Necromancer. And there are many, many myths of Virgil. And I use, to a degree, all of them in this book. And Virgil is a very major character, but he isn't the central character. And
he doesn't guide you. He doesn't guide you to hell.
No.
That's the one role that you left out.
Yes. Right. Well, actually, it gets a little difficult for one of the characters because he gets very peeved with her. And he's peeved, and she certainly goes to a bad place.
Uh-huh. And he ain't going with her. That's the big difference.
Oh, no.
I'm not
going to be your guide. No. This is not a guide.
Will you read for us?
Oh, sure. I'm picking simply because I had to pick one. You know, this is a chunk well into the book. The young girl has just killed a very unattractive monster in a completely foreign place. Elfina sat up carefully. Her head throbbed, but mostly that was bearably. Once a flash blinded her, but she felt as though her skull were being ground between millstones. It was just a flash, though, gone as suddenly as it came. She turned her head and threw up, leaving a splash of bile on the baked earth beside her. She immediately felt better. Enough better, she smiled to herself, that she began to wonder where the next meal would come from. On the ground before lay the idol she had used as a shield. She rotated it so that she could look up at its remarkably ugly face, but she didn't pick it up. You may call me God, mortal woman, the idol said. Its iron tongue licked, but it had already cleaned as much of its face as it could reach. So long as you provide me with regular sacrifices, I will continue to spare you. Anger, then amusement, danced through Elfina's mind. Between them, the emotions brought her back to full alertness. I won't call you God, she said. She curled her feet under her, but she wasn't quite ready to rise yet. And since I'm not staying around here, although she didn't have any better place to go that she knew of, you'll have to find someone else to sacrifice to you. Elfina leaned forward, preparing to get up. The horse-headed giant was already bloating. Dead on the ground, it looked even bigger than it had when she was fighting it. Wait, said the idol. Elfina thought she heard desperation in the raspy voice. You need me, Elfina. You won't be able to do anything without my help. That was pretty much Elfina's opinion, too, but she wasn't sure that talking stick would help much. She said, what sort of help? Will you call me first, the idol said, or perhaps chief? It means the same thing in Ashangi. Elfina made a production of considering. I'll call you first, she said, if I have any reason to speak to you in the future.
David Drake reading from his new book, Monsters of the Earth, just out this month. He's going to appear tonight at Barnes & Noble in Cary for the book launch. You have written and are well known for your work in military science fiction. Is this kind of fantasy a break from that, or is it a kind of, in your mind, in your creative process, a continuum?
My first novel back in 1979 was a fantasy, not horribly dissimilar from this, but I'm a much better writer now. I began writing military science fiction after writing horror, and we're talking short stories here. The military science fiction really took off. I'm a nomvet. I was writing with the viewpoint of somebody who had, I'm a veteran of the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment. We were the spearhead of the invasion of Cambodia in 1970. And having been dragged out of Duke Law School to to do this, this was not my idea of a good time. But I was there. I did it. When I came back, I wrote. And I wrote stories that were not getting published. Editors tended not to be veterans, and I was writing stuff that was a lot harder than most of the fiction that was out there. It wasn't anti-soldier, which was the norm of the day, but it was very hard-edged.
Hard-edged in what way? Did you take into account the political climate and perhaps the politics of that war, or was it just from the soldier's point of view?
Just from the soldier's,
That's
it. It was just from the soldier's point of view. And it doesn't matter how just or how justified or how anything a war is. It's the same for the man on the ground. And the thing I keep saying to people is that when you make the decision to send troops out in pursuit of national policy, you have made the determinant of your national policy a 19-year-old kid without much education and an automatic rifle. He is now going to make United States policy. And the notion of, well, we'll send troops in to keep peace. Soldiers do not keep peace. They are trained to kill people, to destroy things. Sometimes that's what you need. But be darn sure you know what you're doing when you send them in. And I'm just writing, I'm not doing a lot of it now, but I was just writing stories from the viewpoint of the troop who, you know, if there's an artillery spotter in a cathedral, you blow the cathedral up. I mean, the artillery spotter is an immediate problem for you and your buddies. And the cathedral may have been there for 1,500 years, and sorry, it's not there now.
Also, the complexity of the rules of engagement. I mean, Vietnam, we had free fire zones, and soldiers were moving in and out of places where, truly, if you can believe it, our policy was any man, woman, or child in that area could be shot on sight. That was the free fire zone or bombed. But then you move in and out of these zones, and you're supposed to keep all that in your mind as a fairly – and remember, these are draftees now.
I know a story about that. A buddy of mine who was – he was actually at the – I was drafted out of Duke Law School. He was in a PhD program in biology at the University of Chicago. You want to talk about your best and your brightest. McNamara got us all when he did away with the graduate deferment. But my buddy got transferred from the Black Horse a couple of weeks early, and he was with a pacification program. And he walked into the major's office reporting, and he was wearing his losing unit patch, that is, the patch of the unit he had been in previously on his right shoulder. This is quite proper. And it was a Black Horse patch. And the major was furious. You know, take that off. You're a bunch of brutal murderers. The Vietnamese are terrified of you people. You should never have been moved out of War Zone C. And of course, that was true. But we hadn't made the decision to move us out of War Zone C. And
in War Zone C, and just tell us who the Black Horse unit, what they're responsible for.
We're the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment. We were the only independent cavalry regiment, and we had tanks and armored personnel carriers with extra guns, and we went where they told us to go. There's been a recent book out, Black Horse Riders, about A Troop, slightly before I joined it, rescuing a unit of the 1st Air Cav, simply by going in and doing it, and just charging in and doing it.
These days, you know, it's a lot easier to create mayhem and destruction from the air. We target more precisely. We're thinking about selected targets now in Syria, as though no human, you know, as a matter of public policy, and with fewer people on the ground and fewer people at risk, it's an easier decision, it seems to me, to make with less. It's a kind of moral hazard in some ways, would you say?
Well, remember, I come from the days of arc lights, where we couldn't move troops into Cambodia or Laos, but they were bombing the hell out of them. And this is not a new concept. From 30,000 feet in the air, all the decisions are easy. I've seen what bombs do. I've seen what shells do. I haven't seen what missiles do. But I will tell you, you do not make a situation better by firing warheads into it unless what you're trying to do is kill everyone. And, you know, if that's the point, then that'll do it.
David Drake, thank you very much for being on the program. David Drake's new novel is called Monsters of the Earth. He's going to be at the Cary Barnes & Noble tonight for the book launch. We've got more information at our website, wunc.org. Thanks for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.